Conservation Venue.
Okay, I would like to convene the Finance Committee. We're too short of a quorum, so in the interest of time, what we will do is ask members to present the bill and take any questions from the members that are present, and as the chief author, if we get to your bill before we have a quorum, just ask you to wait until we actually take action in case something comes up when the motions are actually made. So the first House file is 2758. Representative Lilly, if you would care to review the bill for us, and then we'll entertain any questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2758 ratifies labor contracts and compensation plans for state employees. These are currently outstanding. Are they outstanding? They're outstanding contracts, and we've gave them temporary approval. The Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and so these contracts need to be ratified, or we go back to the old contracts. This bill has kind of been through quite a few committees along the way here, and we're excited to be here this morning. I have Mr. Hubinger with me, and maybe he can go through the actual bill if you like. On the back page, I'd like to show folks these contracts actually are pretty reflective of the times that we are financially. And the Republicans seem to enjoy the back page. It kind of shows the graph that there seems to be a flattening off of the costs related to these settlements. And just bear in mind that if we do not do this, there's some steps that are cut out in these contracts. And if we do not pass these contracts, we will revert back to the current contracts, and it will actually cost the state more money. So that's there. I'd like to pass to Mr. Hubinger, if I could.
Okay, welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. That subcommittee reviewed these contracts and plans and provided interim approval. I thought I'd just highlight the major financial aspects of the contracts. The contracts do not provide any across-the-board increases in either year for any of the employees. Step increases are frozen in the first year of the biennium. Steps are available in the second year for those employees who are eligible for them, those employees who are not at the top of their salary ranges. That's about half of all state employees. So those employees will get increases of between 2.5% and 4% in the second year. There aren't any major changes made to the state employee insurance program. Minnesota Management and Budget estimates that the cost of these contracts this biennium is 0.57%, with an impact of about 1.7% on the next biennium. MMB also points out that in the cost of these contracts, about 40% of the cost is due to increased employer contributions for pensions for state employees. That was required by a law that was passed in 2006. Another 35% of the cost of the increases is for the increased cost of health insurance in the second year, and about 20% of this cost is actually the salary increases for the step for the steps in the second year. I'd be glad to answer any other questions if I could.
Okay, are there questions? Representative Khan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, since this is a money-saving bill, it's obviously the perfect place to amend on what bill that passed the House last year, which is the ability of the to go to negotiations for domestic partnership benefits.
Okay, that was a rhetorical comment.
Well, I guess.
Okay, any other questions?
It did pass this committee, and it, Mr. Chairman, well, it did pass this committee, and it did pass the House last year. So I guess it's, you know, amenable at any point.
Okay, Representative Biskins.
Well, Mr. Chair, seeing as we're into rhetoric and rhetorical statements or questions, I would clarify that this bill doesn't actually save money. It reduces the increased costs that we would normally see if this bill were not passed.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hiskins, that is true, and if I were negotiating, they'd probably be even higher, so.
Okay, we do have a quorum present, so Representative Kahn, would you like to move the division report?
Yes. I would move the State Government Finance Division report for House File 3682.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
2758.
Okay. 20, wrong page. 2758.
Okay. The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Kahn?
I'll move House File 2758 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Okay. The motion is before us. Any further discussion then on the ratification of contracts? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We also have Representative Benson, the minutes. Have you had a chance to review them?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have, and I move them.
Okay, the Representative Benson moves approval of the minutes for Thursday, April the 8th. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Bunn, we have your bill up next, and we have the updated fiscal notes. So, Representative Benson, would you move the division report?
Mr. Chairman, I move the House Health Care and Human Services Financial Division Report for House File 677, the Second Committee Engagement.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Benson?
I move House File 677, Second Committee Engagement, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Bunn?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to seek a little guidance from you, given I haven't done a licensing bill in this committee before, and usually it's an omnibus bill. How much overview of the bill do you want me to give versus focusing just on the financial component?
Well, I think some folks have some understanding of what the bill is, and then folks will be looking at the fiscal note, being that this is the Finance Committee, but they should have a basic understanding of what you're doing.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. This bill comes about as over several years in the past, there's been attempts to develop a bill to address licensing for tattoo and body artists in this state. A version of this bill came to the licensing division in the House last year. At that time, I felt that there was numerous problems with the legislation, both in terms of being over-regulatory and also not sufficiently fine-tuned in terms of the health and safety issues. So we did put a hold on it at that time. Over the interim, we did a couple things. First of all, the Board of Health did a study of this issue, and then also at our request, the Department of Health did a study of this issue, including some serious field work to look into what was actually the practices going on in Minnesota. As a result of that, just before this session, we received those two reports. In addition, we reached out further to the body art community across Minnesota to the extent that we could identify individuals who would engage with us on this topic so we would have greater input into the topic. Unlike other areas of licensing, which are often brought to us by professional organizations of one kind or another, this is a much less organized, free-spirited industry, has that tradition. They're not formal schools to be trained in these things, for it's more challenging, thus, to determine how to appropriately regulate it. The emphasis of the bill comes from two sources. The primary impetus this last couple years has been from the Red Cross, the regional Red Cross of the Upper Midwest, and from the blood banks in our state. Their concern there is currently there's a national policy in place in terms of blood donation that if you've had a piercing or a tattoo in the previous 12 months, you're not eligible to give blood under national guidelines unless there is statewide regulation to ensure proper blood pathogen education, blood handling, and sterilization at these sites and with these professionals. Therefore, there was a concern on the part of the Red Cross that we have some sort of statewide licensing of these professionals and technicians. So the Red Cross and blood banks have worked closely with us to achieve this. Their concern is for this at this time is that the access, the pool of people who can contribute blood in our state is declining as a result of demographics. With the aging of our population, more and more people have diseases and other conditions which exclude them to be eligible to give blood. So as we get older, and yet we might need more surgeries and more blood available, there's actually a smaller pool of people who can give blood. You know, more recently in the last couple of years, we lowered the age at which people could give blood, now down to 16, I believe was the number. And so we have younger people now involved, and we're wanting to bring more younger people in. A very large number of young people in the teens and 20-something age groups have various kinds of body art today, and so this has become an issue. Secondly, the second impetus for the bill is the artists themselves, at least the ones that are engaged in the process and we've been talking to, which is a pretty broad community of them, would like to have further regulation of this industry in this way. They have seen a lot of abuse of practices. They view themselves as very professional. Most all of them already meet the standards in this bill, and they want to make sure that everyone engaged in this work is doing it in a safe way with appropriate sterilization conditions and education and blood pathogen. Basically, in a nutshell, what the bill then does is it licenses both establishments where these activities go on and makes sure both their site is appropriate for appropriate health and safety standards that are necessary, and also license the technician that they've had appropriate training in blood pathogens and sterilization issues, and also have that updated over time as necessary. In attending to both these types of regulation for both the establishment and the individual, again, we have tried to have the minimal level of regulation necessary to meet the health and safety issues without going overboard and requiring them to remodel buildings or put in unnecessary equipment or change the way they've practiced for years and years. So we've tried to keep focused on those health and safety issues. So that is what the bill does. And in terms of the implementation of it and the financial implications, it has a traditional structure of licensing in that the department, based on the number of establishment and technicians they believe might exist in the state, has estimated a fee level for the establishment and for the individuals initially. The establishment would be every 3 years, but with initial temporary license while they're conducting the inspection throughout the state, and for the individual every 2 years. So they've done an estimate of how many might be involved and the amount of fees that would pay its way for this effort. And as with other licensings, as they know more and the system gets up and running, they'll know whether this fee level is the appropriate level and adjust it over time as necessary so that it covers its costs and pays as it goes along. And again, in the usual form, the initial startup money to have the staff to do this, the inspections and the oversight of the licensing will be a transfer of money from the special revenue funds to cover this initial cost and then be repaid with the fees as they go on. Again, it's supposed to be a self-sustaining effort paid for by the industry as we go along. So that's what you'll see outlined in the fiscal note and in the bill itself.
Are there questions?
Mr. Chairman, it isn't often that I read a bill that has a word I don't know in it, yeah. So I always think I need to. On page 2.5, what is radiohyphrication?
Oh, yeah. Wasn't that on the Regency Camp in New York? No,
obviously not.
Thank you, Representative Hahn, and I'm going to let, actually, I thought I knew every word in the bill as well, and I thought you were going to ask me what suspension was or some of the other terms. Well, I'm going to let Tom Hillmeyer from the Health Department take this one.
Okay, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Hillmeyer with the Minnesota Department of Health, and Representative Hahn, I'm unable to tell you exactly what that is.
Mr. Chairman, do we pass bills where we don't understand what the words in them mean?
Yes.
No.
Lots of times.
But there's a computer in the room. Maybe we could find out.
Well,
and it's like he might know.
Representative Benson, we got a pretty good group of people. Maybe he's volunteering. Maybe
not to be held to this, but I think it has to do with a process by which radio waves break down fat cells.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a former social studies teacher. And that means that he's quite a generalist.
I've never undergone any of these tests.
There's another part of the bill that I would suggest for most of the members of this body, excepting my good colleague across the table, Representative Biskins, who inveigh against government regulation and then voted against what Representative Biskins and I were trying to do yesterday at the end of session. And I'd urge them to look at the procedure in 4.7 to 4.8 and suggest that that might be useful for them.
And that vote yesterday was close enough for, I'm sure you'll continue your work. Let's see. Representative Kiffmeyer.
I have to follow that. Thank you. I have two questions, Mr. Chairman. One has to do with the Red Cross. And Representative Bunn, when we're realizing that part of the reason for this is so that we can increase blood donors, and that if this is passed, then we would be able to have more blood donors. It's one thing if you have these things done in Minnesota. But as you know, there are states around us. Do you know if the states around us or other states, or is there a methodology for the Red Cross that they ask the question? I mean, if they've had this done in Minnesota, that's one thing. But if they've had it done outside Minnesota, have you addressed that issue, or do you have an answer for that?
Yeah. Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer. Currently, the Red Cross deals with this in two ways. First of all, they have a sign at their entry saying that at the entry desk saying that there's the saying if you've had piercing or tattooing in 12 months, you won't be eligible. So they self-select themselves out and walk back out the door. Beyond that point, there's also a form they have to answer questions to, and they are asked those questions again. And you're absolutely correct that they will need to be revising their form in a variety of ways based on our investigation and our study of this issue and developing the bill, that they need to be a little more specific in terms of the depth and breadth of the practices they mention on that form, that there's more going on than just traditional tattooing and body piercing, and they may need to be clearer, I think, about what all people have to consider. And they also have to be clear about the location of where they've received this. And that currently is also, I think, included on the form. But some of our senators already have statewide regulation. Wisconsin did this a couple years ago for the same reason and has statewide licenses as well to address the same problem. So several of our surrounding states already meet the requirement, but I completely agree that the Red Cross form will need to have location of where the procedure is done as part of their screening process.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, thank you very much. And then the second question has to do with language in the bill, in particular on line 3.1 and 3.2. It seems beyond the pale to think, you know, I'm just, some of these other things are the same thing with the, 2.4, and then there's some other ones too that are really very intense kinds of procedures, to use the kindest word I could think of. And so when I look at this one, though, it's the suspension of the body from a fixed hook's place through temporary piercings. Mm-hmm. Now, a body is substantially heavy, and so this sort of thing is not only just a matter of piercing, but it also involves the stress and strain and risks, nerve damage. And I'm concerned about us even including this in this bill, because it's basically a license that says this is okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's one thing on some of these other things, but this to me is just a real serious question, but maybe you can explain it in a way that, whatever.
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kempmeyer, I'm going to respond, and then I'll ask Mr. Himmelmeyer to add to it if he'd like to. In the field work that was done by our health department, they did an excellent job going to various locations in our state to see what practices were occurring in our state already. This and the other things listed in this bill are among practices currently occurring in our state. Currently, they are entirely unregulated in most areas, and maybe entirely unregulated because I'm not even sure they're addressed by the current tattoo and piercing regulations at the local level that it do exist in some places in our state. So some of the things that listed here have been previously entirely unregulated. We had numerous discussions about this. It is clear from both the health department's perspective and mine and others, and the artist in these communities, the tattoo and piercers, that you are correct. We are not clear that some of these things should be even legal or allowed. That's certainly the case. And I think the health department, I, and others who've been involved in this legislation do believe that's a future area of work that needs to be attended to. The question we faced is, they're currently not regulated, and as a first step, do we want to make sure that until we do that further investigation of what's going on, should we at least ensure that they are following sterilization procedures and practices that are safe in that regard, as opposed to just have them completely unregulated at this point. What was observed in some of these areas, and again, I think they agree with you that there's questions whether they should be allowed, period, was that some of these practices, although they appear quite extreme to us, are being done with tremendously sanitary conditions, evidently, in terms of what was observed by the health department, verging on the medical realm in terms of how they're conducted. So I think you raise a completely legitimate question and one that requires further work on behalf of the legislature and the health department to address going forward. But I'll let Mr. Hillemeyer add to that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I think this is a decision for the legislature. I think that including such things as branding and suspension in the definition is not an explicit authorization to perform these activities. And similarly, there's nothing in the law that prohibits these activities except where it concerns minors. The law does not prevent a local jurisdiction from going further and preventing these activities. If the legislature decides to prohibit these activities, then it raises the issue of how it enforces that prohibition. And in this bill, the department suggested in its report that unless the legislature was willing to impose criminal sanctions, it would be extremely difficult to enforce a prohibition against some of these activities.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the explanation, and it puts you in a quandary as well. But again, my concern is that while it does not expressly forbid or say you have to, it just the legitimizing it just purely through the fact that it's licensed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole intent of any other licensing is to exactly do the case. They're legitimate activities, and we want to set up those parameters. So the alternative, you know, I think that's the quandary that I'm in. You know, what's the alternative to that? And leaving them out, usually it would seem more preferable that you wouldn't license something if you, you know, prior to it, you'd continue your investigation and maybe come back with some of those recommendations. But I'll continue to give it some more thought. I don't know that I have an actual step to take right now, but.
Okay, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've got a couple of questions. I do have concerns with the bill in its broadest point, but there's some specific language in this bill that I have tremendous concern with, and it's government intervention into the rightful responsibility and role of the parent. On page 14, lines 6 through 10, you list two different types of body art, and then it appears to me an undue intrusion of government into the parent's role where you add the language regardless of parental or guardian consent, and I find that I'm flabbergasted that we would write something like that into state law, that we would actually say that the state trumps the parents on an issue with the parent-child. Could you explain why that's there?
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I reply to Representative Biskins, I want to say one more point on the Kiffmeyer issue. It is the view of the Health Department after this study this summer and others that in terms of even the more mainstream things of tattooing and body piercing in the bill really do deserve criminal penalties associated with them. This bill had already gone through, you know, all the committees in the Senate last year, so it was determined that we did not want to do that this year and proceed, but we expect to come back next year with another bill to ensure criminal penalties. And I say that because the Health Department can't be everywhere 24/7. In terms of even the more mainstream practice, we have people doing it in barns, in mobile units, at parties, you know, particularly outstate, you know, and so we do need to be able to have 24/7 kind of enforcement of this stuff, and that probably most likely cannot be done without criminal penalties. So I say this to indicate to you that there will be another opportunity. Not only, you know, we can further discuss it this year, but there will be an opportunity next year as well, in my view, to further work on the issues you raise in that context. To Representative Wooskens on this issue, I have a listing in front of me of all the states that do regulation of tattoo body art in the United States, and about 90% of them currently do restrict it to 18 and above for permanent procedures like tattooing. The thought behind this, and this, and the artists are very supportive of this, is that if there's a parent involved and it's a youth, and this under current law, you could be an infant and have piercing or body art done, and under current lack of regulation, this, and under many of the regulations and some of the regulations at the local level. Their view is this is something the individual will have with them for life, very difficult to remove, and therefore you have to be an individual of autonomous free will and thinking to make a decision about this being on your body forever, and that it should be a decision left to that adult individual and not imposed on them, on their physical being as a child in that setting. And they go even further. The artists really think that it's a very personal decision and should be not unduly influenced by others in your life, whether it's your spouse or your friend or your parents or whoever it might be, that, you know, this is something very permanent and it should be something you as an autonomous individual make that decision, and that someone who's a minor doesn't have that capability yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative will probably just have to agree to disagree on that, but you did bring up an interesting word, and I want to know if this was discussed in committee and if there is an exception here. You used the word infants. Is circumcision anywhere in this bill exempted?
Mr. Chair, that issue did not arise, but as you'll note in the language of the bill, there's a section, and maybe Mr. Holman can point at me to it quickly, which indicates all the medical professionals and others who already have within the scope of their practice activities that might be considered, you know, piercing or cutting the skin, and explicitly indicates that those practices continue to be protected under their current scope. So it was never in our intent to infringe on or affect any current activities that are under scope of practice of other professionals medically, and I would hope that would apply to others in the religious side as well that may engage and have currently the legal right to engage in that kind of practice. But something we certainly could check on to make sure, but the language is all there to make sure that that's not the case, but circumcision isn't explicitly mentioned as one of those.
Did you find the section somebody was asking?
Two things. One, again, to Representative Biskins, under the definition of body art, we think that also would address that, which is on line 1.14. But then I said also there's a section later in the bill that explicitly exempts all current medical professionals of various kinds that engage in activities that might be construed to pierce or cut the skin, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Which is starts on 7.3.
Okay. Representative Biskins is ahead. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, Representative Bunn, you'd referred to the state of Wisconsin had enacted this. Was it last year or more recently than that? If they have enacted it, what are the results? Are they finding their blood donors among young adults have been maintained or increased, or do we have any verification of the impact of this type of legislation?
Mm-hmm. Rep. Sinbun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll ask Tom Hindler if he has a comment on that. I know that the Wisconsin's in the last 4 years. I don't know the precise date. I have read the legislation, but I don't recall the date on it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Szymanski, we did not speak with the department in the state of Wisconsin. A representative from blood banks is indicating that they have seen positive results in blood donor participation since the passage of their law.
Representative Szymanski.
One more unrelated question, and thank you to Representative Kahn for bringing this up on the tongue bifurcation. My question is that a non-surgical procedure, or is this involving cutting of the tissue?
Rep. Sinbun.
Mr. Chair, since this has been raised in a previous committee, I now have the detailed answer to this question. It actually is done as opposed to a cutting. It is done through a serial piercing procedure, in that one after another, they do a piercing through the center of the tongue, letting them heal in between, such that eventually it is complete bifurcation. Is that
okay, Representative Rukavina?
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to Representative Bunner, the gentleman from the Department of Health, you know, I try to use common sense around here, and I'm wondering on page 14, Rep. Biscuit, my buddy Biscuit over there, how on lines 14.11 to 14.16, are we going to have breathalyzers in the tattoo shops, or how are you going to actually enforce this language? Can you tell me how you're going to enforce it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, many of the prohibitions in this section, more than requested, were almost demanded by practitioners in the community. They view these things as protection in terms of delivering their services so that when they are performing these procedures, they know that they are dealing with a person who has legitimately given consent and knows what they're doing. And if there's any indication that the person is inebriated or lacking the wherewithal to give that consent, they do not want to be involved in performing a procedure with that person.
Why would they do it? Why would they do it? That's their choice. I mean, the way this language is written, if somebody, personally, I'd have to be half bunned up to go get a tattoo in the first place or a piercing of some kind. But, you know, I mean, when you put this in law, somebody has a beer and goes into a shop. Now, this person is technically violating the law. If you look at E. Mm-hmm. So how do you enforce? You were smiling the whole time you were telling me your argument there, gentlemen, from the Department of Health. So the point is, why do we put in law something that's totally unenforceable, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing if you're falling down drunk, and I wouldn't give a tattoo to that person either, but or pierce their nose or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Or whatever.
Wait, listen. What are you smiling over there for, Paul? The way you've been voting recently, you've got that nose pierced all the way to the governor's office. But in any event,
something else.
In any event,
something else.
Back to my question: how do you enforce this? There's no enforcing of this of that language, and it doesn't really make any sense to put it in.
Mr. Chair,
we are being televised, and we might make the comedy channel if we keep it up.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to let my mother know that I don't have any piercings. I want Mom to know that.
Okay, Representative Rukavina, are we done?
Well, I'm just
I would like an answer. How is that enforceable?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, it might be difficult to enforce, but if we had sufficient evidence in terms of testimony or a written statement from a coworker, a written statement from the individual customer, it would be a sufficient basis for enforcing the provision.
Well,
Representative Rukavina, or is
no, Mr. Chair, I just see the situation down the road, and, you know, where somebody actually said, I had a beer and I went in and I got a tattoo and now I don't want it, and my parents told me they won't pay for the rest of my college education, and so now I'm going to have it removed for free or whatever because he should have known that I had a glass of wine before I went in.
Okay, any further discussion? Well, seeing none, then Representative Benson renews his motion that House File 677, the Second Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Ways and Means. Do you want it? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now go down to Representative Peterson, Senate File 2339. And Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate File 2339, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and place on a general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here this morning before the Finance Committee. This bill was heard before Public Safety Policy, passed unanimously, and a number of good discussion. And I have two expert witnesses in case anyone has any questions this morning. My first witness would be Deputy Chief Dan Pleckenpaul, who's from Plymouth, Deputy Chief from Plymouth, and Professor Joseph Olson, who represents the NRA. They also were at the testimony at the committee and are here to answer any potential questions. There is no fiscal note on this bill. It's gone through in either the House or the Senate, and it has passed unanimously in the Senate side also. And if you have any questions, and it deals, I better at least tell you that it deals with the possession penalties for possession of firearms in schools.
Any questions of Representative Peterson? Representative Howells.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Peterson, if this happened a year ago and a 15-year-old, maybe 16-year-old, was charged with a gross misdemeanor because they forgot they had a paintball gun laying on the back seat. And they called the police, and it was parked in a school parking lot, so he was guilty of having it there. But he stuck with that gross misdemeanor. Would passing this law go back in time and maybe make that a misdemeanor, or is he just stuck with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as far as I know, this goes forward. We don't have a grandfather clause in here, and this would be new legislation, and I suppose it would give, the judge always has some leeway, but maybe one of my expert witnesses can answer that.
And if you can identify yourself before you speak, thank you.
Yes, this is Professor Joseph Olson. I'm a law professor at Hamline University Law School. I need to clear up one thing. I'm president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance of Minnesota, and I'm their registered lobbyist. The NRA has their own lobbyist, who is not me, and with whom I sometimes disagree. The general rule with regard to changing of statutes is that you're guilty of the offense that you were convicted of at the time. You're guilty of the offense that you did at the time of the act. And so if it was a gross misdemeanor at the time of the act, you're guilty of a gross misdemeanor. There has been some discussion in other states. There have been some court cases that have drawn the line as to whether the case is still on appeal or not. This is not an issue that has been dealt with in Minnesota, so I would presume that the general rule applies, which is that if on the date that you committed the offense, in other words, last year, your young man committed a gross misdemeanor. And this bill doesn't change that. Now, this perhaps is an issue that the legislature ought to look at, but certainly not till next year.
Representative Hall said. Any further discussion? Well, seeing none, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 2339, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Isn't it a Senate file?
Or, excuse me, Senate file. Yeah, Senate file 2339, this time of the session. You got to keep in mind the Senate files. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you. And we have House File 1320, Representative Swales and Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Health Care and Human Services Finance Division report for House File 1320, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman, I move House File 1320, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to first describe this bill as something that I feel rather personally about. Many of you know that I am a teacher, and I was teaching senior English this fall. And in December, one of my students stood up, and then he collapsed on the floor of my classroom, and he had a grand mal seizure. I was very proud of my seniors. They immediately moved the furniture away from this boy. One of the students said, we need to go get some help. So they went to get the school nurse and the principal and the football coach because they knew that we would have to lift the student. And somebody else said, let's get out of the classroom and sit in the hall so that we can take care of what's going on in here. And my students were very proactive, and this young man was seizing for about 90 seconds. It was a very terrifying moment for him, and it was also a moment where I realized that having a seizure can happen at any time under in any situation. So this particular bill is one that I'm very proud to carry, and the purpose of it is It will enable people with epilepsy and their physicians to better manage and monitor the use of medications to prevent breakthrough seizures and better identify the potential cause of a breakthrough seizure. We have agreement with these various organizations, the Board of Pharmacy, the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation, and the Academy of Neurologists. We've gone through several iterations of the bill, and language has been created that accommodates the concerns of the various stakeholders. I have sitting with me Mr. Kevin Goodnow, who is the president of the Minnesota Epilepsy Foundation, and I would be more than happy if you have questions to either direct them to me or to Mr. Goodnow.
Okay. Are there any questions on the bill? Okay, seeing none, then Representative Benson renews his motion that House File 1320, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And welcome to, I don't know if everybody here, because it's been a while, knows that you're a former member as well. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your support.
Welcome, and your comments, I guess, weren't necessary today, but you never know. So thank you.
Brevity is always a virtue. Yes,
sir. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have House File 3682, Representative Kalin. And Representative Kahn.
Chairman, I'll move the subcommittee report, the
Government Finance Division report for House
The motion is before us to adopt the division report. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Kahn?
I move House File 3682 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us, and I understand then that there is an amendment that the author would like. Is this an author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Kahn will offer the amendment. I'm amenable to it. It's
one that you're requesting, or?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Representative Kahn on the amendment, then, and that'll put the bill in the order you want to present it, I assume.
Yes, okay. I'll move the A1 amendment.
Okay, the motion is for the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. If you want to describe the bill, then as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3682 makes some technical corrections to the PBEEP financing program that we passed in 2008, also known as the Roadrunner Bill. PBEEP stands for Public Building Enhanced Energy Efficiency Program. It's a program to use lease purchase financing to reduce energy consumption and costs of operation in state buildings, as well as provide technical assistance and access to financing to identify and implement those most cost-effective energy conservation and efficiency improvements. What the bill does is it authorizes a master lease program for that financing structure, as well as working on the advice of the Attorney General's Office and professional staff at MMB to also authorize a line of credit as another means of capitalizing those expenses. The amendment that we put on the A1 amendment is a proposal from Representative Pepin that had broad agreement in Representative Kahn's committee, just related to disposal of old buildings. With me is Wayne Wasmosky from Admin, who can speak briefly to the motivation for the bill and the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, Wayne Wasmosky with the Department of Administration. Just real briefly, this is just a measure to streamline the process for any time we want to dispose of buildings that are obsolete or are a safety hazard. Essentially, what it does is, prior to that, current law has us going through the chairs to get approval, and that oftentimes, in particular with DNR, for very they have many very small buildings. We've often referred to this as the outhouse bill, because we're really talking about small buildings that have very little value, and it really is just a measure to cost effectively and efficiently dispose of those buildings.
Okay. Any discussion? Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, either for Representative Kalin, the witness, or maybe Representative Kahn, I'm just trying to understand the second part of the amendment that we put on and why that's a part of this bill. It looks like we're making a change with regard to the membership of the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association from MMB to administration. Help me understand what's going on there.
Well, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first of all, we've already passed these. Both of these parts were part of the state government finance part of whatever it was, 1671 or... the budget balancing bill, and ran into the opposition of the Senate chair, who considered that they didn't have budget implications. The second part of the amendment was part of the transfer of MMB of the work that part into MMB, and that one position was correcting a mistake in that last transfer. So both of these have no opposition except from the Senate chair of the state government finance division.
Well, then I'm probably all for it, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
One was part of, Mr. Chairman, the second one was part of the governor's original bill. So I spent all my time in that conference committee arguing for Republican positions. And the next one was from an amendment that came from Representative Pepin. So, and we lost both of them.
Good luck next time.
And I think that was...
Well, that's why we're giving it to Representative Kalin. We thought he'll do a better...
Resolved, I think.
I think so.
Right to the end.
I did not have the sufficient support from my House conferees, I will point out.
held out to the bitter end.
Mr. Chair, two points. One is we have the agreement of our Senate author of this companion to add these two provisions, so I hope that that has cleared the way. And in the parade of former members, Mr. Rhodes is here, who I think needs say as little as Mr. Goodenough, but I think former members are so imposing to this body that their mere presence at the table, I think, gets us to pass bills. So thanks for being here and your help.
You want to take that risk,
Mr. Rhodes? No, Mr. Chairman, no, thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor of House File 3682, that it be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the General Register, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. We now have Senate File 2690, Representative Hayden. Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate File 2690 to second engrossment be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, good to see you on a wonderful Friday morning. Senate File 2690 is a bill that helps children. It is. It has several parts to it, the first being it allows children that are in care, that are in foster care, it allows their foster parent or whoever they're in care with to allow them to get a provisional driver's license. Right now we have that the parents are, if you're under 18, the parents have to sign off for a child to get a provisional driver's license, and kids that are getting close to age and out of foster care who don't have a permanency plan, this allows the foster parent to sign off on that, and we think that that is important for their life skills. Article 2 is kind of a miscellaneous provision that modifies some adoption background requirements and allows counties to look at to initiate background checks and look at certain issues there. It's something that the counties brought. Article number 3 is really foster care. It's something that we helped to do yesterday, but it just aligns our statutes to the federal statutes for children that are aging out of foster care and want to stay in till 21. And then Article 4 is a father's provision that just gives fathers more of an opportunity to be involved with their children, especially those that are have been taken out of the home. And with that, I stand for questions.
Okay,
I do have
are there questions. Is there any discussion? Shemansky.
Shemansky. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hayden. On the foster children driver's license, it probably isn't addressed in this bill, but in terms of insurance for the foster child being licensed, how would that be addressed? Is that a consideration in this bill, or should that be under some other legislation?
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shemansky, I'll let my testifier, Mary Regan, address those issues.
Okay, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. What this does is give the foster parent authorization to sign permission for the child to take driver's education, get a provisional license, and ultimately, if they decide to, get an actual driver's license. The insurance question is a separate one, and the foster parent can decide whether or not they're going to allow the foster child to drive their car. And if they do, then the child would have to be covered through their insurance policy.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hayden, I haven't had a chance to review the bill closely or think about it much. I'd like you to speak a little bit more to the why behind moving the benefits available to foster kids from, ending at 18 and moving them up to 21. That I'm concerned about the cost for county social services agencies, the potential cost for the state. I have some concerns as to whether that might, and I don't know, I'm just curious, whether it might provide a disincentive for some people who might otherwise be willing to be foster parents, but you know, may not want to be responsible for somebody who you know, from 18 to 21. I don't know. I'm just curious if you could talk to that a little bit, and maybe I'm not understanding the change correctly. So help me out a little bit.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles. I'll just give you kind of the general issues, and I'll let Ms. Regan get into some of the more specifics. Part of the thinking behind, and this is kind of a national trend behind having children go from 18 to 21, really revolves around outcomes for kids. Unfortunately, we do have a lot of kids that are graduating out of the foster care system, and there is a lot of research and evidence that says that kids that graduate in the foster care system end up as not as productive as kids that were in a traditional home. A lot of these kids end up in the criminal justice system. A lot of these young people end up on our public assistance system, as well as a lot of the young women have children way before we think that they are ready. So this is a growing trend. There is a Federal Families Connections Act that that states and counties can pull money down in order to support kids that want to be in foster care from 18 to 21. So I liken it to most of us when we left to go to college, or when we left, or when we turned 18, we typically got a lot of support from our parents, at least to 21, a lot of us a lot longer than that. I know that I did. So this really just allows children to have that extra support that didn't have the opportunity to be adopted if they were in permanent care. Hopefully, Mr. Regan, or Mr. Regan can talk to you about some of the specifics and this process of how we got here.
Ms. Regan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Coles, are you referring to Section 3 in Article 2, or?
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Regan, I guess it's kind of scattered throughout the bill. And again, I haven't had an opportunity to hear this bill in committee before, so you know, maybe I'm not fully understanding what the bill is proposing to do. But there seems to be an effort to move the presumptive graduation, to use Representative Hayden's term, from foster care from 18 to 21, or at least an ability for individuals who turn 18 to remain in the foster care system for another few additional years, for some good reasons, as Representative Hayden suggests. But I'm trying to understand why. I'm trying to understand the impacts, the fiscal impacts. You know, we have problems not only here at the states, but our counties are having enormous challenges as well. And while this may be a good idea, in fact, maybe a very good idea, I'm interested in understanding a little bit better the fiscal impact that this could have, not just on the state, but on local units of government as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I think those are great questions. Actually, though, all we're doing in this particular bill is clarifying a couple of things that were already in statute. It has long been the case that children who are aging out or approaching their 18th birthday, 6 months prior to that time, counties are expected to notify them that they have the option to remain in care, and that's been in statute for a long time. One of the things that we did last year, that you did last year, was allow children who decide to leave care, that say, I'm ready to go, I don't need any more help, to come back between the ages of 18 and 21. But because of the potential fiscal impact, language was added that gave counties a bit of an out if they couldn't afford to do it. And it says what was added was, to the extent funds are available, they shall ensure foster care. The what we're doing this time is just clarifying that children who are wards of the state, which is already currently in rule, we're clarifying in statute that they do have the right to come back. So this doesn't change anything that isn't either an existing rule or statute. There are provisions related to court jurisdiction up to 21 in this bill, and that's basically to give the courts the option to maintain jurisdiction if it's in the best interest of the child. It doesn't require that they maintain jurisdiction, but there will be new federal dollars available in October for kids between the ages of 18 and 21 to support foster care. And while it's not entirely clear, there's an expectation that the federal government's going to require that the child be under some court jurisdiction in order to access those funds. So this is just preparatory language that would give the court the option to maintain the jurisdiction in case everybody wants the child to stay in care, and that will allow us to draw down federal dollars to support that.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fiscal note that we have shows no fiscal cost to the state, but it does indicate a fiscal cost to the local units of government. I don't see a, and I'm guessing their local impact note hasn't been requested. I'm curious if we have any estimation as to what those local costs might be.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles,
Ms. Reagan.
We're not aware that the local governments perceive that this will be a significant burden. As I mentioned last year when we had language that would have extended the care or allowed children to come back, the local governments did step forward, said it would be costly, and therefore you added language that said it was they had the out up to available funding. With all of this language, we have worked with the counties, we have talked to the counties, none of them have indicated any concern about this representing any significant fiscal cost.
One last question, Mr. Chair, Ms. Regan. You mentioned that this move to making services available or benefits available to 21 is kind of a national trend. How many states have done that? And has anybody, reversed the trend in light of fiscal concerns? Again, I understand why we're doing this, and I think it's a good idea. But just because something's a good idea doesn't mean that government, particularly in these times, can or should be doing it. So I'm curious, you said it's a trend. How big is the trend, and has anybody pulled back in light of fiscal concerns that you're aware of?
Ms. Regan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, I don't know the numbers of states that are doing this. I know that there has been a longitudinal study of the outcomes for kids who remain in care versus those who don't up to age 21, conducted by the Chapin Hall Center in Chicago. And the what the data suggests is that there are significant both financial and developmental positive outcomes when kids remain in care, that they tend to get a higher educational degree, that they have more earnings over time, less criminal involvement. As Representative Hayden indicated, they tend to get pregnant less. So there are all kinds of ways in which, even though there might be some more money spent on them between those ages, there's less money spent on them in the long term.
And Mr. Chair, just a comment. Representative Hayden, I very much appreciate what you're trying to do here. And I'll chat with you after committee, because this is an issue that I care a lot about. But just because we might save some money down the long run. I mean, we hear that argument about almost everything that comes through here, and I appreciate that. I get it. I don't even disagree with it necessarily. But if we don't have the money today, we're not going to be able to do this. And so that's my concern, Representative Hayden. I'm going to vote no on your bill today here in committee. I hope that some of my concerns can be satisfied as we move toward the floor. I'd like to be able to support this, but I'm concerned about the implications of this for local units of government. I'm concerned about some of the other issues that this may mean, but I'll chat with you afterwards about the bill. I really do appreciate what you're trying to do. I know your heart's absolutely in the right place, and I think there's some good reason maybe to do this, but I've got some concerns, so I'll chat with you, and maybe we can work on them as we move to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, I would love to work with you with this bill. I think that just because the way that our process works, we're not able to work as closely together, but I think that a lot of your fears and a lot of the issues have probably already been addressed, and that there's any additional ones, I'd be more than happy to sit down and work that out before the bill hit the floor. So really appreciate that.
Okay, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name, but yesterday I received an email from NCSL, the National Council of State Legislators. And in the email, it said, what is your state doing with extending foster care from 18 to 21? And I talked to Representative Huntley about it, and I actually forwarded it to him to respond. So it's kind of interesting that this shows up today. I probably should have done some more research yesterday. But I thought in the email that there was an interest from NCSL on because of the federal reimbursements that are available. And you indicated that it would only be available if it was under a court order. Two questions. Is that only available under court order? And what is the status of the federal reimbursement for both court order and other type of activities for this particular program?
Ms. Regan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, you're correct. The NCSL and the National Governors Association have both taken really strong positions recommending that foster care be extended to age 21 because of the studies that I mentioned earlier. The new federal money is really just, it's the same federal money that's been available for kids in care up to age 18, and it's now, as of October, it will be extended to kids up to 21. The court jurisdiction is about the placement. The federal government requires the court to be involved when a child is placed out of the home. It's not a court order in the same sense as a criminal situation, but it's court jurisdiction to make sure that the federal rules are being followed in terms of reviewing the placement, that it's in the best interest of the child. So there's always court involvement. This will, in our current statute, that court involvement has to end at age 18 for the child. We're just giving the option for the court to extend it to 21. And again, we're not entirely clear what the federal government's going to require, but in case they require court jurisdiction extension, we'll have that in place and ready to go in October.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, I need a little bit of clarification. Isn't just about every out-of-home placement some kind of court jurisdiction?
Yes.
So under the current rule to 18, does the federal government participate in the cost of that out-of-home placement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, yes. It's under the Social Security Act, Title 4E, okay. and the federal government will reimburse the county, in this case, 50% of the costs for room and board of that placement.
So, Mr. Chair, if we do this under this particular provision starting in October, if it's the best interest of the child for them to be in foster care for until 21, we will pick up the federal reimbursement automatically. Is that true?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'd like to have a clarification. You sounded kind of absolute that when they turned 18, that the funding would stop. And then earlier you mentioned something about a six-month notice. And I'm a retired high school teacher, and I'm taught mainly seniors. And I was sitting here thinking, well, at least 5/12 and probably more of my senior students were 18 before they graduated. Can you clarify that just as a matter of information? What happens when you do turn 18 and what your options are, especially if you're still in high school?
Mr. Chair, the options are supposed to be to remain in care if that's what you want and what the county will support. What we lose at 18, what we've lost at 18, is the federal support for that. The county can continue to pay.
So that is absolute with the federal, then you turn 18, and even if you were still in high school, you're okay. That's what I was wondering.
But again, that will change in October.
Okay. Any further discussion? If not, then Representative Benson renews his motion that Senate File 2690 be recommended to pass. Wait a minute, that's the wrong House. Senate File 2690, the second engrossment be recommended to pass and placed in the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, we're down to House File 2678, Representative Junkie.
Mr. Chair, I move the Agriculture, Rural Economies, Veterans Affairs, Finance Division report for House File 2678, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Representative Junkie.
Then, Mr. Chair, I'd move that House File 2678, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-refer to Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Junkie.
Members, this is the Omnibus Ag and Veterans Policy Bill, and I do have three author's amendments, I guess, if we could address those first.
Do you want to put those on before you present the bill?
Yes.
Okay, why don't we take, just the way that I have to be handed to me, A13, is that?
Yep.
Okay.
And then it's technical corrections and addition subtractions to the bill.
So Representative Junkie moves the A13 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. The next one, Representative Junkie, I have in my hand, is A-12.
A-12 is a bill that we neglected to put in. This bill's actually passed the House body last year, and we should have had it moving forward again this year for further discussion. It's actually a con bill on putting in place a mechanism should the government ever, federal government ever approve industrial hemp, that we'll be able to do that in Minnesota. Again, it's a bill that we should have put in and didn't. I talked to Magnus Hamilton Torkelson, who are on my committee and the leads and members, and they thought it was a good idea to put it on here too. So
okay, so the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. And then the final one I have is A14.
A14, and Mr. Marks can probably help us with this. I need to do an oral amendment on some, probably on one line. After the period on 1.7, we have to state that this is a one-time only appropriation.
Okay, does everybody have that then, the addition? Okay, the motion is before us then that we adopt the A14 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried.
And then, Mr. Chair, I'll go into the bill briefly, but I will recognize that the A14 amendment we just put on takes...
Representative Lincheski.
I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't get the A13 amendment. And I know we've already adopted 13, 12, and 14, if that's right. Hmm.
It was in your packet.
Yeah, I don't... That's the A-12. Was there an A-13?
There was an A-13. Yeah. It was the first one we did.
It has, I can see Ms. Novak's, and it has a repealer, and I was just wondering what the repealer was.
Here it is. Oh, yeah. Grab Tim Chunky.
It looks like this now.
Oh.
One page.
All income.
There's a report that was done on native prairie seed that's no longer needed, okay. And then there was some language last year directing the department to rent out their space and apply it to livestock investment grants, but we've applied that money elsewhere in our finance bill previous, so that's what the repealers are.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Always good to watch the repealers.
And then, Mr. Chair, I will... point the committee to A14 we just adopted. That appropriation takes care of the fiscal note hole that was in the fiscal note before you, so actually we will have a slightly positive fiscal note moving out of here. So that should take care of that fiscal problem. Members, this bill is, again, it contains 23 different sections with mostly different things in them. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I will point to a number of the items in there. I mean, there's everything from wolf damage compensation, the 4-H, how to fund 4-H. A bun bill is addressed in here. We've got language on ethanol to address perhaps a federal waiver that's coming this summer that we need to be prepared for before we leave session if that happens. We actually have Secretary of State language in here, and I will tell you that this is one of the last vehicles out. It does pertain to some of the farm liens, and so we put it in here, but broadly it's a protection of Social Security number information that the Secretary of State absolutely needs done, and we're going to be putting Social Security numbers out onto the line, and we don't want to do that, and there's someone from the office here if we need further explanation on that. There's corporate farm law language in here, lien priority language. The $40,000 you just saw was for a terminal capacity report, a Magnus bill.
to understand our terminal capacity on propane and anhydrous ammonia around the state. There is, in the veterans section, everything from how to fold a state flag to veterans cemetery, county veterans service officer language, and other miscellaneous veterans preference for teachers, and other miscellaneous articles in there. Again, I can go into any one of those more specifically, but again, there's 23 different sections, and most of them have different topics in it. And happy to go into that, but for this committee's purpose, again, the fiscal note now is a positive, I believe, about $6,000 by when we were done with the amendment.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Junkie, I have, in regards to this electronic access under the Secretary of State office, it's kind of fun to see language that we got in place and did these things when I was Secretary of State. So, and of course, you know, the ongoing issues of electronic filing. So I do support the policy and all of that. But I do have a question. There are four sections or four areas where the effective date is 30 days after they're certified. And in another bill that I worked on, this was an issue as well in discussing with the revisor's office. And when you don't have actual effective dates, it's hard for them to know when does this go in statute. Now, they're just issues like that. And so I'd requested then that the Secretary of State give us a date specific on or before that they felt that they could do to. And the Secretary of State office agreed to that and did come forward with those. I've asked him today, and Mr. Gelman is willing to come down and testify in regards to doing that. So if I could maybe ask for that to occur at this time.
That would be fine. And I assume you heard the question, but if you could identify yourself officially.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Gelman. I'm Deputy Secretary of State. And Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I agree with you. We should change the effective dates. I wish it was as easy as just changing one effective date for all four sections, but unfortunately it's not, and I would just been going through here very quickly, and I believe for Section 19, you would want the effective date to be...
Can we get page number?
Page 10, Section 19. Actually, it's the effective date is on page 11. That effective date, I believe you would want to be immediately after enactment.
And Mr. Chair, you know, we can go through and do this, or this does have to go to Ways and Means, and I'd be happy to do an author's amendment there.
Either. What we can do, we've got several people who have questions. Yeah. I think what we can do is have committee staff
we can do
work
that.
On that, and then we'll revert back to it
okay.
if they're done today before
yet?
We
All
need
right.
to act on the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I did not intend that they would have to come up with these at all. Today that we would do that, and that yes, Mr. Chairman, at the next committee, I think you certainly do need. I know that these are different enactment dates, but that at the next committee, that those could be maybe just inserted through the author at that time. That would be fine. I wouldn't expect you to do it today.
So, Mr. No. Chair, I'd ask the Secretary of State's office to work with our research staff to get that.
We have
that
a few
amendment.
Minutes, and if they're done by the time we're ready to act, fine. And if they're not, we'll take care of it as the bill moves forward.
All right. If they need, they can go talk right now.
Yeah, because we have at least four other
All
people
right.
that have questions at any rate. So maybe you can get together.
Thank
Representative
you, Mr.
Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill has obviously a number of multi-jurisdictional issues, and on page 2, determining the fair market value, this is the compensation required for livestock destroyed by a gray wolf, and you have now said that that fair market value is determined by a university extension agent and not a conservation officer. Just maybe I'm wrong, but somehow it would seem to me a university extension agent might not be the most equipped with that information. And then how does that relate to the deleting the language on 224 to 230?
224.
Representative Junkie.
Well, this is an Olin bill, I'll tell you that first. So I'm not sure if the department or research remembers why. I mean, the extension age is still there. We didn't delete it. They do that now. So we're not changing anything. We're actually taking that duty away from the conservation officer, who's less equipped, frankly, than a farm extension agent to do crop damage. And I think that was probably the reasoning behind that, is they really don't have the capability to do that and aren't doing it at this point in time, the conservation officer.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking more of that deleted connection to the language on 224 and 230. That's where I saw a connection.
Mr. Chair?
On that point, Representative.
Yeah, I think to help answer, I think the connection is that the extension agent and the claim is on lost animals, not on the damage to the wolf itself, I think.
Right. No, it's not for wolf damage. It's
for a livestock owner, the loss of an animal.
Yes, I understand that.
For animal damage.
Mr. Chair, I guess I was trying to figure out what the deleting the language on best management practices, what the impact of that was, because that's where I saw the connection.
I don't know the answer to that, but certainly I'll have Representative Olin come talk to you before Ways and Means.
And then the other two. In a bill like this, where this kind of cross-jurisdictional, on lines 310 to 313, we're saying it is the goal of the state that environmental and resource management permits be issued or denied within 150 days, and it's the Commissioner of Agriculture that shall establish management systems designed to achieve the goal. Since it's environmental permitting, wouldn't one think that it ought to be the Commissioner of Agriculture and?
Well, Representative Hausman, first of all, we changed that slightly in the amendment so that it's not the goal of the state, but it's the goal of the Department of Agriculture. That was one of the amendments we did. Secondarily, I'd love to do that if Representative Virginius would let me, but that was a bill in her committee, and she hasn't brought it forward yet. It's a Hortman bill that was actually a Chamber of Commerce and an environmentalist bill who had worked together on it to give some goals for these permit turnarounds. And since we thought it was a good idea and we are turning those permits in agriculture, we have maybe 8 or 9 different environmental type permits that we do in the Department of Agriculture, and we're happy to try and meet that goal in agriculture and put it in there. So we put that piece of the Hortman bill that was agriculture related in here. I suggest maybe there'll be some ongoing discussion when Representative Wagenius brings her omnibus bill out in the next week or so too on that. The additional parts of that, but I concur. I would like to have the whole Hortman bill in here, but I don't yet.
And then the Mr. Chair, the other one would be on page 9, Federal Clean Air Act waivers. What's the impact of Federal Clean Air Act waivers?
Madam Chair and to members, this is dealing with ethanol and transport and handling of ethanol. And there's a E15 waiver that's probably going to be enacted in August once we go home. And this is all in preparation. That's similar to what we did with E10 language, so that our pipelines and our transport facilities and our terminals are able to handle that product. It's very similar, if not identical, to the E10 language. But we have an E15 waiver coming, and so we had to make that fit to the new federal law that's coming.
Representative Hausman, is that okay? Representative Paymer. Representative Kahn.
Oh yes. What is the penalty for not folding the flag properly?
I don't know.
Body piercing.
Get hung up.
And again, that was brought...
I'm not sure I could follow those directions, so I don't know who can.
I mean, it's just an interesting bill was brought through the Veterans Affairs Veterans Subcommittee, and they had hearings on it. And, you know, everyone knows or probably learned somewhere along their youth or adulthood how to fold an American flag properly. And there is a proper way to fold the Minnesota flag also, so you display the emblem and other things when it's all folded, and particularly when you put them in display cases and other things. So we thought it was interesting, and we ought to recognize that in state law or statute.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Does this then bill then become a vehicle for changing the state flag now?
Huh?
Could we do that?
The what?
Does this bill now become a vehicle for changing the state flag, or for
perhaps
establishing
that would be,
a process to change the state flag?
I don't know if that's germane or not, but if you've got an amendment, the speaker will determine that on the floor.
Okay. Any further discussion? And by the way, a lot of the government and civics books, at least with the American flag, have a section on flag etiquette, and I suspect that that's what would apply with the Minnesota flag in this instance. I don't know what the law is on that, but there is etiquette, you know, that you you follow. Well, we don't have that amendment back, and I indicated we would just proceed with the bill, but they're getting it prepared, I guess, for the next stop. So Representative Junkie renews his motion that the House File 2678, the first committee engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. We'll now go down to House File 3334. Representative Junkie. Or, excuse me, Representative Champion.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I move the Transportation Policy and Finance Division report for House File 3334, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Junkie. You want to move the bill?
There's also an author's amendment, Mr. Chair.
But you should move the bill first.
Oh, now that it's here, I can do it. I'm a committee member. Okay,
that's right.
I got you. I move House File 3334, first engrossment, recommend a pass, and placed on the general register.
Okay, and now you have an amendment, and do you want to add the amendment to represent the bill?
Yes.
Okay.
Move the author's amendment, A1.
Okay, the motion is for the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative
Mr. Chair and members, this bill originally probably had a fiscal note, but through the committee process, we've amended it and changed it to reflect no cost at this time. What it deals with is an alternative bidding process, which is a process that allows bidding for both bituminous and or asphalt and concrete road surfaces as we bid out road projects. It's a it's something that I think the department, and I will acknowledge, was moving that way anyway, but we want to make sure that they move that way and continue on that route. It brings more companies that are able to do road work into the mix, as well as hopefully save some money because more people will be bidding on that process. I will also acquiesce that as I work with MnDOT and the asphalt and the concrete folks, there's still a couple minor questions in here on a couple issues that we continue to work on, and I have given them my full word that we will continue, and if we need to make another author's adjustment on the floor, I'm happy to do that. But for the most part, the majority of this bill is supported by all those involved, and I know of no overtly crazy objection to it.
Okay, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Junkie, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit to what this, on page 2, the uniform standard, the life cycle cost analysis based on net present value method of comparative analysis of alternative paving materials. Could you just give a little better sense of, you know, when we're, I guess my question is, when we're saying in state law what type of analysis the transportation agency has to do, I'm afraid we're tilting it one way or another versus looking strictly at the cost and long-term drivability of the
materials. Maybe just a brief description of what the alternative bid process is in my layman's terms. We know, I guess all of us would probably understand that concrete has a longer lifetime. Asphalt has a shorter lifetime. So when you do an alternative bid process, what you do is a life analysis, not only for the pavements as they're put down, but also in asphalt's case, how many times you'd have to come back and overlay that in the life cycle. And so they analyze that along with many, many other things. I'm giving the real simple point on it, so that at the end of the day when you're bidding maybe a 40-year road. And what's the total life cycle cost on that road? And again, it brings the asphalt and the concrete people in on an equal basis to bid. Makes instead of apples and oranges, it's more apples and apples at that point. And so I do have folks from MnDOT here as well as the industry if you need more in-depth discussion. I see our engineer moving in here now. So I don't know if I've answered you at all, but I know a guy that can.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, I guess what I would just like is some reassurance that we're not making trade-offs in engineering standards in order to accommodate a different set of contractors. Or, in addition, to save money in the short run that was going to cost us more in the long run.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kurt Turgeon. I'm the MnDOT pavement engineer. And the net present value method is kind of engineering econ 101. It is a standard method for doing any kind of an engineering cost comparison. So it's not going to favor one industry or another based on that term.
And Mr. Chair, I guess the follow-up question then, and there's no way that changing the type of analysis that's used is going to allow us to save money on projects now that's going to cost us more money later?
Mr. Turgeon?
No, the Mr. Chair represented the whole intent, as was described to you, is to understand the entire cost cradle to grave for an extended period of time. So it is not going to push costs out. In fact, it should keep you from doing a cheap fix today and having a much more expensive fix being done in the future, because you have to include not only what are you going to do today, but what are you going to do over a 50-year period or a 35-year period. So you have to include those costs that you're pushing out and bringing back to today's value.
And then, Mr. Chair, that sounds like a really good idea, but why does MnDOT not do that now?
We do, and that's some of the conversations here is the difference between what we are already doing and what we feel we need to have in the law. I mean, if we're up to MnDOT, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We were already doing alternate bidding. We are doing net present value. There was some interest from the industries to try and codify that. A couple years ago, we had this law was put on the books. Again, not that MnDOT's urging, but it was put there, and now it's being modified. This isn't MnDOT's bill, I guess.
And, Mr. Chair, I would add that, as I said before, I do believe under the new commissioner in particular that we are. MnDOT has moved into this mode and continues to move forward. Obviously, they have projects, and this bill doesn't affect any projects that are on the books or being worked on, but moving forward, we want them to do that, because in the past we have seen projects that could have realized this type of bidding that did not, especially out in rural Minnesota where most of our contractors are asphalt people. We only have a handful of concrete folks in the state, and a lot of times those jobs are given to out-of-state contractors. And it's our goal to bring in more in-state contractors, more in-state jobs, and more in-state bidders on jobs, which ultimately I think will bring the cost down in the upfront bidding process, just because you have more people in bidding and it's more competitive. So we see that as a good thing, but I do, as the engineer mentioned, they are moving that way in a big fashion now with the new commissioner in particular, and we appreciate that. This just gives us that comfort that it will continue into the future, because we have seen some start stopping on that in the past.
Chair, just one last follow-up, and there aren't any safety or other kinds of drivability, other kinds of concerns that might arise from doing more asphalt type roadway projects as opposed to concrete?
No.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Yeah.
managed to kind of... Oh yes. Is there any action, Mr. Chairman and Representative Junkie, going on in the federal government on this? Does Congressman Obestar have anything that in any of his bills or any of the subjects in his committee on this alternative uses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm not aware of anything happening at the federal level. The actual policy position of the Federal Highway Administration is they don't care for alternative bids, primarily because it does get into some complicated details as to just what constitutes a comparable pavement and how long will it exactly live, if it's going to last 9 years or 10 years, one versus the other, adding an inch, changing the aggregate qualities. You get into a lot of details, and Federal Highways thinks those things are maybe not easiest to figure out at the day of bidding. So they have actually kind of taken a hands-off approach to this.
And so you know of no action to change this or do anything like this on the federal level?
No.
Okay. Mr. Turgeon. Okay, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be beyond the scope of this particular bill, but since we have a testifier here and also to kind of follow a step further with Representative Winkler's question, 2 years ago when I traveled through Germany a lot, I noticed much of their Autobahn now is blacktop. And I found that they do things a little differently there, particularly in the thickness of the overlayment. It's double, usually, the thickness that United States, or at least here in the state of Minnesota, seem to use. And they argue that it dramatically increases the life expectancy of those roadways. And I'm just wondering whether or not either this piece of legislation or the department has ever considered those processes, only because it seems that we're constantly in, you know, this period. We always talk about Minnesota as either winter or it's road construction. And I'm just wondering whether or not the department ever looks at that as a long-term cost saver.
Mr. Turgeon.
I guess I'm not 100% sure on exactly the question. I can tell you there's 80 million people in Germany, and there's not anywhere near that many taxpayers in Minnesota, so they do have a little different tax base to work with when they're building their roads.
Well, it's a... Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. It's a federal system, so they have states there as well. So I don't know whether it's all funded through, the national government or state governments, but Germans do have a reputation for building things to last over a long period of time, and it seems that the expense of completely redoing our roads every few years with these thinner overlayments is an issue I think someone ought to look at.
Mr. Turgeon.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is one of the things that life cycle costing does, is make you look at what's today's cost, what's the long-term cost of having to repair it again in 5 years. There are analysis that would show that it's cheap. It depends on what you're buying and how long you need it to last and how long that replacement cost is going to be, and that is what this analysis does, is look at those kinds of costs.
Listen.
Just follow up. I'm not interested in proposing something that eliminates more employment, maybe, but I am interested in finding ways of saving the state money over long term.
Does that analysis take into account the societal cost, I guess would be the way I'd put it, when a road is shut down and you're having to use alternative routes and so on, and if you're repairing more frequently, as opposed to doing it with a long-term repair record in mind?
Mr. Chair, the analysis can include user costs. Right now, MnDOT does not include user costs in the analysis. It's sometimes easier to figure out what those costs are going to be versus others. I think when we looked at doing that, one of the projects we looked at was when we shut down Highway 36 in North St. Paul. We knew what the traffic volume was going to be through there, or had been. So you can estimate the added cost is easy if you have a detour and you say, well, everybody who used to go through here is now going to take this other route. They've got added time, added miles, added wear and tear to their car. When we shut down Highway 36 in North St. Paul, we really never were able to document where that traffic volume went to. You know, did they go to 94? Did they take 694? Did they take local streets? It obviously went to a variety of those places. So then to try and parse that out and decide how much user cost was created by shutting down Highway 36 in North St. Paul, it becomes a very difficult process and arguable depending upon which side you were benefiting by adding those costs into.
And when I reference societal cost, traffic patterns would be one issue, but often and when there's been repair up my way, and sometimes it was new construction, but the impact on businesses and so on with more difficult access. I know they did some work on Highway 55 not far from my district, and it became very difficult for quite a long time for people to get in and out of some of the businesses along there, and I'm sure that people were choosing other alternatives, shopping other places. And the more frequently you do that, the cost on businesses as well as change traffic patterns. But at any rate, you could take it into account is what you're saying, but you don't.
It's possible, but depending upon the geometry and where you're at, it gets more and more difficult to include those costs.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This just reminds me of a question I have. Does this would the study take into consideration also the recycling of asphalt? I know there's a whole process of taking the old asphalt, heating it up, and recycling it, right? Is that part of what will be studied?
And Mr. Chair, briefly, that is one of the things we talked about in transportation was the more we go to asphalt, the more we're able to recycle that old material. I think up to 30% or something is recyclable. So what we're talking about is we have little ribbons of oil wells running around our state, and we're able to reuse them rather than take new petroleum products. A lot of that is reusable. I don't know the exact percent, but I know the engineer maybe has a better idea, but that's a very good point that asphalt versus concrete, the asphalt is somewhat recyclable and when you take it up and put it back down.
Representative Clark.
Well, one of the questions that arises for me is actually in my neighborhood, we've in the past had one of those hot asphalt plants, which really smells and also releases to the air certain kinds of toxins that we're concerned about. And so I'm just wondering, if that's all going to be studied. And, I mean, there is the recycling positive, and the negative part is at least unless they have some new technology and way to do it so that they're capturing
that odor.
The odor and also the other, particulates that are released in the air are a public health issue. So could we just, I guess I'd like to ask that be considered in there and find some place to do it other than my neighborhood.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative, it does raise an interesting concept here. There are things we can do to asphalt paving that reduces the heat at the plant, that would reduce the odors and some of the things that you're talking about. But by doing that, we would also increase the cost per ton of that product. And by increasing the cost per ton of that product, then they become less competitive to the concrete alternative. So you can see that this does become a very intertwined thing when you start looking at environmental impacts, traffic impacts, costs of initial construction, costs throughout the year of this of use. There are a lot of different things that can be included. As yet, we are doing some experiments with the warm mix product. The benefits are primarily on the environmental side. We don't see benefits to us as a pavement owner and builder and user. So it does become difficult for the Department of Transportation to say it is definitely worth X number of dollars per ton extra to eliminate that odor if, in fact, that asphalt contractor then is going to lose the job to a competing concrete supplier. Those get to be pretty messy conversations.
Mr. Chairman, just a final comment. I understand that, and I'm just asking you to calculate the environmental cost to a community, and especially we know that, over the years we've learned that there's certain things in asphalt that are hazardous to the workers when they're laying it down, men having more problems with prostate cancer and that sort of thing. I'm just asking you to consider the public health consequences and don't leave them out.
Mr. Turgeon.
Mr. Chair, I think we'll include that. I am aware that the province of Ontario in Canada is attempting to use a calculation in their alternate bidding to include that, but I'm not I'm not aware of the details. I am aware that that is part of what we're dealing with. Yes.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Junkie renews his motion that House File 3334, the first committee engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. We now have House File 3224 by Representative Beard. Representative Champion?
I move the Transportation Policy and Finance Division report for House File 3224, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Champion?
I move House File 3224, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Beard on the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the motion, Representative Champion. Members, what we have is a bill that was brought to us by MnDOT, the agency. It started out just looking for specific statutory authority to enter into some creative and alternative financing investments to get projects done, things that they've been offered over the years. And I think you remember a couple years ago there was a well-intentioned but failed attempt to, on the Crosstown project, actually have the contractors finance the project. And, of course, it was a shot that came, or an idea that came in an untimely fashion on short notice, and actually I think needs to be vetted through this process as well. But this legislation would authorize MnDOT to be able to actually entertain those projects going forward on a more timely fashion, enter into negotiations with the contractors and with other interested parties to finance things like intersections, interchanges, lane additions, and so on and so forth. In the last committee, there also was amended onto the bill, Sections 1 and 2, which deal with the design-build process. One of the things, the ongoing things we're learning in design-build, course, came out of the 35W project, where interested companies put forth their best efforts, which included intellectual property, but then they needed, MnDOT felt it was fair, and so did the contractors, that they be paid for the efforts that were required to put creative and intellectual effort into a design that then became proprietary. And by paying them for that, MnDOT reserves the right to actually use some of those interesting ideas going forward, and to compensate them for the unusual amounts of time and creativity required. So that's also now part of the bill, Mr. Chairman. I also have Mr. Bradley Johnson from MnDOT here to further explain the nuances of the bill and the technicalities, if you wish. And we could stand for questions, but if you'd like, we could call Mr. Johnson down to testify.
Yeah. Representative Beard, either of you or Mr. Johnson, when you mentioned contractors financing it, and I see it's various entities could.
Yes.
A question I would have is level playing field. I suspect there may be some contractors in a better position to self-finance, if you will, as opposed to some others. And when you're going through the bidding process and so on, want to have some assurance that we do have a level playing field among the various contractors.
Good
so
question.
You or Mr. Johnson.
And it's one that was discussed briefly in the last committee, but we're happy to talk about it again here. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Chairman, let me introduce my witness to talk to that.
Mr. Thank Johnson, you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is actually Brad Larson.
Larson.
Larson Johnson.
Being a Carlson, I
what's the difference in Minnesota here? Yeah. Representing Minnesota Department of Transportation, thank you for the question. Mr. Chair, could I just ask you to restate that question? I didn't catch all of it as I was walking up.
Well, during the testimony and when this was discussed, as was pointed out a couple of years ago with contractors being able to finance a project, I just wanted to have some assurance that it would be a level playing field, because I can see a situation where some contractors may have the financial resources that others do not, and to make sure that everyone has equal opportunity for the bidding process, and it not automatically screens some out simply because they can't self-finance or finance the project, was essentially the question. And I understand from Representative Beard's comments there was some discussion of that issue in transportation, but if you could comment on that this morning.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. Thus far, we have not identified any projects that we are proposing currently to use that alternative financing provision that's in the innovative finance bill. It's just an option that's out there if a contractor or some other type of private entity or a nonprofit or some other quasi-governmental type entity really wanted to accelerate a project, were willing to advance us or loan the department the money to get the project done today, and then we would actually repay them those dollars in the years that we have those dollars programmed or planned in the future. So any type of project that we were to open up to that type of thing would be open. It would be through a competitive bidding process. Anyone could bid upon a proposal like that. But we would not even try to do that unless we had someone coming forward saying they're interested in accelerating this project using this method. So it's really hard for me to say right now how many contractors in Minnesota would be in a position to even do this. This is not something that's happened too often around the country. Michigan has tried a couple projects that were accelerated using contractor financing, and in that state, they're generally, these contractors don't have the ability to finance it using their own capital, their own equity. They generally will go out and secure financing through some sort of private debt financing means, banks or other means.
Well, the point of my question, and when you answered it, you referenced some group would have to come forward, a private nonprofit or some government entity. That's one issue. But there's also the ability of a potential contractor to finance the project temporarily. As you point out, they would be paid back. But we have small, medium, and large contractors. And my concern was that there be a level playing field. Obviously, you want a contractor that can do the work, but they may not all be in the same position relative to financing the project, is my point. And I wanted to have some assurance that there would be a level playing field so that medium-sized contractor that can do the work and do good work would have an equal chance to get the bid as opposed to maybe a larger contractor that could self-finance. That was the point I was trying to make. I guess we got several hands up. Representative Solberg. And
well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm concentrating a little bit on the last section, the page bottom of page 2 and top of page 3. And as I understand the process of funding transportation, we look at the availability that's in the dedicated account and also in the bond account that we had authorized, the legislature authorized, and we then appropriate a sum of money that might be available to the department, and they make the priorities. If I read this correct, particularly on page 3, we have this alternative form of funding through the either loan, grant, or credit assistance program. And the assistance may include it, but not limited to loans and guarantees and lines of credit. But what I'm troubled by is that the commissioner may enter into agreements to repay the financial assistance subject to the availability of state money or other dedicated revenue or resources with the approval of the Minnesota Management and Budget. It seems to me we have just taken the Minnesota Management and Budget and made them the legislature. And it also gives the authority for the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget to not have to do things out of the dedicated account but can take it out of the general fund because it says availability of state money or other dedicated revenues. I'm very, very troubled by this particular bill because you are then just with the approval of Minnesota Management Budget, and if you end up with this type of a line of credit or something, and the project is done, you may not have a financial obligation if you just take that off, but then you have a moral obligation somewhere along the line. It's going to be back into the legislative process. I just am very, very troubled by that particular section, mm-hmm. and troubled by the whole concept of this bill.
Okay, we have several people. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Turning to Section 3 of the bill, Representative Beard, I have a similar concern about lack of legislative involvement. The way I read this, and maybe someone can correct me if I'm wrong, it talks about agreements to for private nonprofits to finance or invest in projects. That sounds to me like that could include either outright ownership or a long-term lease. I know that in the Chicago area, there was a stretch of Chicago Freeway that was either sold or leased to a Spanish company for a period of years. I think it was a lease, actually, like 30-year, 40-year lease. That's a major policy decision. It may be right, it may be wrong under the circumstance, but I have a lot of problems on line 2.20 and 2.21 with saying it's just the MMB commissioner, not the legislature, that would have to sign off on something like that. I mean, if a future governor or Department of Transportation decided to sell Highway 494 to a French company or something like that, or lease it for 30 years, I'd like to think that the legislature would have something to say about that. And I don't see that we do in this bill. Could you respond to that?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, two thoughts. First of all, to back up to the your concern about fairness and level playing field for contractors to compete. I know that in the design build process, the pre-approved contractor list assumes that there will be consortiums of local contractors and other contractors that will be submitting and competing for the contract. So you may have a large prime contractor that will put a project together that will pull in several other local contractors to do various facets of the job, whether it's earth moving or electrical work or the actual paving and so on and so forth. And they have enough lead time that they can go out and arrange their financing if they can make that part of their proposal. So I just wanted to add that commentary. Now, to Representative Simon and Ms. Solberg's points, these are important points. And one that, when it went through the Transportation Committee, we did not anticipate or interpret that it would be that way. I think the reference to MMB assumes that the legislature has a passed and approved a budget for the Transportation Department to live within, and MMB can approve whether or not they're going to be able to, DOT will be able to move those monies around in such a way as to make the payments that we're obligating if we move a project forward. I should also make clear that these projects just don't come in out of left field. They're in a transportation improvement plan. And if someone steps forward, like the Elk River project towards Rochester, for instance, and says, I know that 20 years down the road we've got an interchange here, but here we have an investor who's willing to invest in a biosciences park. Can we move this up? MnDOT says, well, we don't have the money program. He says, I'll loan you the money. Let's build the project. And then somebody at MMB has to actually look at MnDOT's financing plan and say, well, we do have the money coming up down the road to make the payments on this, and so on and so forth. Those are the examples that are anticipated in how this works. Certainly, it's not this legislator's intention to give MnDOT the authority to run outside of the legislature and create money or obligations to the taxpayers of this state. Particularly, you know how strongly I feel about the dedicated funds issue and the sanctity of the Trunk Highway Fund. The anticipation is that this must come from Trunk Highway Funds that are set aside for building roads and bridges and so on and so forth. However, having said that, I know that some of our discussion in transportation also involved what if there were commuter rail lines, for instance, where somebody wanted to step up and move some sort of transit project ahead, which is not dedicated money. Now, that's a little more problematic, and perhaps you're raising wise questions that need to be sounded out a little more here before the bill moves forward. I'm sorry I did not anticipate that, nor did the Transportation Committee when we had this discussion. Perhaps MnDOT has something more to say to that. But
Representative Simon.
Well, I appreciate that that's not your intention, Representative Beard, and I take you at your word. In that case, I would offer an oral amendment, Mr. Chair, if I could. On line 2.21, after the word budget,
that's what I'm going to say.
Insert the words "and the legislature." And same thing on line 3.4, after the word budget, insert the words "and the legislature."
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy just to accept that, or you can vote on it, whichever you wish.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, where are we? And you know, I don't know why you want to fix this bill up because it's not a very good bill. And Representative Beard, you know, yesterday in our committee, all the Republicans told Representative Hilty, you know, they really like them. They hated his bill, and I really like you, but this bill, members, you know, I have consistently in two decades fought any attempt to take a legislative authority away from the legislature. And even if you put that in there in the legislature, Representative Simon, you know, as Representative Solberg pointed out, once the money's appropriated, the Office of Management and Budget can say, well, the legislature already indicated that they approved this because they approved the money. I mean, there's a lot more in this bill besides worrying about the Office of Management and Budget, and that is privatization and financing projects and repayment of them for private dollars. You know, we've gotten to the point where we don't have enough money to run this state, and so we're dreaming up ideas that really have me worried. So I don't know why any attempt would be made to fix the bill. I think we should just kind of lay this bill over or not approve it and let,
you know,
and let Mr. Representative Beard fix it up.
I think what we'll do, we have an amendment before us, and we can adopt that amendment, but why don't we see how many other questions there are, and I'm tempted to just lay the bill over for further work, but I would like Representative Beard to be aware of what all the questions are and see if things can be corrected or resolved by a future date. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I noticed on the fiscal note, it says that on the second page of the fiscal note that Sections 3 and 4 of the language of the bill is permissive, and so therefore it doesn't have a fiscal note. But if they do it, then it has a fiscal implication big time. I mean, if we're giving them permission to do it, I mean, I think that's kind of a way of getting around a fiscal note. So no matter what we do with this one, I will request a new fiscal note, and we're not allowed to get out of Ways and Means without having that kind of clarification.
No, good point. I don't know that it's headed there yet.
It's not headed there, but it will.
But you gave a signal as well. Representative Simon, I understand that if we're going to adopt your amendment, you need to change something.
Right. Well, it's...
Ms. Novak noticed something.
Why don't I just withdraw that amendment?
Okay.
And I'm getting a vibe here. I'm getting a lay it over vibe. So... I'll withdraw the amendment and just let the committee do what it.
But I think before we lay it over so people know what the issues are, we'll recognize those folks on the list. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we've had concerns expressed on both Sections 3 and 4, but my biggest concern is on Section 2. Mr. Larson, is it the intent of the department that the reissued RFP would be identical to the first issued RFP, or could the reissued RFP change substantially? And now we've fenced out a huge number of potential bidders.
Hey, if you could identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Green with MnDOT Government Affairs. And Representative Biskins, the concept here is that the reissuance would be only to those teams that were already shortlisted in the first round. So if we discovered that the project was coming in over budget, for example, we might have to reduce the scope of the project, but then we would reissue the RFP to those same teams that bid in the first round.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification of intent, because that gets exactly to my point. You're going to substantially change the RFP, and now you're not going to let potential bidders bid on it. I see that as a huge problem.
Okay, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I, too, like Representative Bearden. Just yesterday on the House floor, we were talking about a joint venture for a college in my district. So I appreciate him always. But I, too, don't like the bill. And I guess there's enough concerns on the table already. But the one that I have is maybe just kind of endemic to the bill that can't be fixed. And that is the worry that if you start having private financing that it might be available for this project and not this one. And we already know, excuse me, on the Education Finance Committee how inequitable education has become when we rely on property taxes and unequalized levies and the ability of communities to pass local option levy referendums and so forth. And it seems to me this is going down that path that just would not be able to be fixed in this bill.
Who's next? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is not so much a philosophical one, but practical. I don't understand how you can save money on a project by asking the private contractor to finance it versus the state financing itself. I mean, if it's worth doing, can't the state borrow money at a better rate than a private contractor could to do it?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. Yes, generally that's something that you'd look at with any type of proposal under either of these provisions, either under the alternative financing one or under the TIFIA. There are instances, though, where you might be able to accelerate a project, deliver a project more cost-effectively using either alternative financing or using TIFIA, because you get different types of more flexible repayment terms, longer repayment terms than you do under traditional financing mechanisms. Sometimes these opportunities don't last very long, so that if you were to come back and propose a more traditional financing source like trunk highway bonding, the opportunity might not be there anymore. So essentially all these provisions are trying to do is give the department a couple additional tools to accelerate a few more projects each year. There's probably not, these are not intended to replace or supplant traditional funding and financing techniques. They're just new tools that if we do see opportunities where we can accelerate a project, get more needs met out there sooner than we can right now, that we can take advantage of these things. And I'm willing to work with all the members here that have expressed concerns to put language in here. These provisions, they weren't intended to give us authority to lease our facilities, sell our facilities in any way, shape, or form. We already have existing authority to finance projects through local government advances, through transportation revolving loan fund, through other mechanisms, and the language that we're using in here is essentially identical to those other financing tools that we currently have on the books, things that the legislature has already approved. So, but we'd be more than happy to sit down with members and talk to folks about ways we could improve this legislation. So,
and that's the way we're headed.
Mr. Chair, can I
Representative Winkler.
Thank you. I have just a follow-up, which is that my bigger concern here is that this is part of a series of steps by the department to make it appear that our transportation needs are less than they are, and that we are pushing off the cost of the significant transportation programmatic improvements, especially in the metro area, into future years. Representative Simon and I had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with the commissioner and others in which they talked about the plan to rescope projects, construction projects throughout the metro area, which is essentially, when we got down to the nitty-gritty of it, a way to build much smaller projects and deal less effectively with traffic and volume than what we've expected in the past. And it's a way to save money. I think having alternative tools to accelerate construction of certain projects now has the effect of making it appear like we are making the long-term investments that we need in transportation, but what we're really doing is paying for it for so long that we're going to end up not having money down the road to build the next ramp connection that we're leaving off the table now. So I have a broader concern about MnDOT trying to make it appear as though the money that we have in the pipeline now can serve the needs that we have in front of us when, in fact, we don't.
Representative Slaughter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Winkler's last point, and then I have another point, is Peter Bell talked about the Met Council about how they're rescoping. And for us in the East Metro, we feel, well, now they're rescoping now that they finished all the projects in the West Metro. You know, and so our projects, that's just a... Well, it's somewhat we do wonder about that. It seems like interesting timing that this is being done right when our projects are up for renewal or for being done. But my concern, Mr. Chair, to the
projects East and West Metro. Well,
to the author, Representative Beard, mm-hmm. I haven't been on transportation in a long time, many years, but it strikes me, isn't there language in the issuance of bids that takes into consideration female-owned and minority-owned contractors to have fair bidding processes? And wouldn't this, if we're talking about an even playing field, wouldn't this affect that?
Mr. Chairman, several years ago when I carried a design-build bill to allow the Department of Administration to expand design-build techniques to some of our vertical investments, one of the groups we worked with was there was a minority contracting consortium that worked with the contractors and labor and everything to make sure that everyone had buy-in and a piece of the pie when that happened. I remember that in that instance, and I know that MnDOT has been very diligently working with a group called the Collaborative lately to kind of update those whole procedures. Running outside of that whole process, I know, has been hugely controversial. I know Representative Champion a couple weeks ago had a very interesting and intense bill in front of our Transportation Committee talking about visiting that whole issue. And there would have to be somebody from MnDOT to speak to that, because it's being handled within the department. And yes, we have set standards for them to accomplish, to reach on how they parcel out and count and score different contract awards and so on and so forth. And that's part of the design-build process also, which is a little different than design bid build, and it has so many more alternatives and gives the department so much more flexibility that's part of this whole process.
Well, if MnDOT could speak to that, intuitively, intuition tells me that if you have your bigger companies that might be able to get the financing easier, that could fence out other types of companies. And I had the occasion to deal with, on the 35W Bridge, the contractor for... in Hudson, Wisconsin, it was a women-owned company who had received a large part of the contract for that bridge. And in their case, maybe they could actually work into this type of process, but I don't know. It worries me, and I guess MnDOT can talk about that, how these smaller companies would be eligible.
Please.
Okay.
do you want MnDOT to probably respond to that just briefly, Mr. Chairman, if you may?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as part these provisions, and I'll attempt to answer your question. I might not get it quite right, and you can follow up and tell me if I didn't. But these provisions that we're proposing here are part of the department's new innovative finance initiative, which is a much broader program that we are trying to establish within the department to look at new funding sources, new financing techniques, new partnering opportunities to try to get more done out there each year, to try to meet the gigantic needs that face transportation. And by no means is innovative finance going to be a panacea for all of our transportation funding issues that we have. But it can be a small yet important part of the solution. We really need to find all kinds of funding sources and financing techniques to meet the dawning needs that face us. And so what we're trying to do here is, in trying to get more projects done out there each year, we're going to provide more work to DBEs. We're going to provide more work to contractors. We're trying to get a couple additional projects accelerated each year that otherwise couldn't be done for several years in the future. So that's all we're trying to do with this bill. Now, I'm not sure if that exactly answered your question, but
I'm going to...
Yeah, thank you. I just like where the path where the bill is headed, which is, I think, to the
It's going to be laid over.
Yes.
And I'm going to recognize two people. We want to be out by 11 o'clock, which is 5 minutes from now. And the two people that have been on the list, so I do want to give them an opportunity for their patience, Representative Pepin and then Garofalo, and then we're going to lay the bill over and adjourn. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably a question for the two of you from MnDOT. I'm wondering, have we already entered into agreements with non-governmental units to accelerate projects? I'm referring to Section 3. And if so, I'm wondering where that has been, if it's been maybe a TIF district, if there have been projects, because we've kind of been talking like this hasn't happened before. But I think that we have done that, and I'm just wondering if you could let us know if that's the case or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative, MnDOT has taken part in projects. We haven't been the lead on projects, but we've taken part in projects where private entities have donated or contributed dollars to projects or right-of-way to projects, but they weren't financing agreements. They weren't necessarily agreements that we were paying back that private entity. And really, those were all done through local governments that had the lead on those projects. Penn Avenue Interchange is an example of that, where Best Buy contributed some money to finish the Penn Avenue Interchange. Another project that we've announced it won't be let here for approximately a year is the 169 Bren Road project, where United Health Group is contributing $5 million to that project. So we've done, we've been involved in projects where private entities have contributed dollars, but not any type of projects where private entities or non-governmental entities have actually loaned the department money and we've paid them back on certain terms over time.
Representative
Pepin. Well, thank you very much for that. We're working on a project in my neck of the woods, one of the projects that hasn't been finished for many years. MnDOT testified against it a few years ago, and I thought it was a great opportunity, but apparently MnDOT didn't and killed the project. So I just wanted to comment on that. And then, Representative Slawick, you may feel like things haven't been done on the East Metro, but I can tell you that there are lots and lots of projects in the West Metro. I can give you one example, 610. We've been waiting for the last 5 miles of that for years and years. So maybe the grass appears greener on the other side, but I assure you the grass is not greener. At least the pavement is not blacker on the other side.
I think, if nothing else this morning, what's coming out is that we have huge transportation needs in the state. Representative Grove.
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. That Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, I would like to withdraw my motion, and I would like to put forth a new motion. And so I would like to put forth a motion to lay the bill over.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? With that, we are adjourned. Oh, be sure you note that it's on Tuesday, April 13th, 9:30, room 200. This committee still has a lot of bills. So
that was very good.
Have a good weekend.